This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver
Commercial
Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to the Vancouver Commercial Real Estate Podcast. I'm Corey Wright.
And I'm Melissa Moretti.
And Melissa, today we have Scott McInnes, who's a partner and a lawyer at Red Point Law on today. And why we reached out to Scott to come join us is it's felt lately, and again, I'm only going to make the assumption it's from the lending side of the transaction, or maybe it's the insurance on the lending side of the transaction. It feels like some things in the past that maybe weren't as important, maybe like estoppel certificates, are becoming extremely important now. From a funding aspect. And you can't blame them. Banks have tightened up. Interest rates are high. They're probably doing a lot deeper dives into who buyers are and who these tenants are. So you can't blame the lenders at all. So we wanted to have Scott come on today and talk about the importance of some of the language in the contracts. Because what happens is, if things aren't getting funded on time, maybe some documents are missing, such as estoppels, lenders' lawyers are being tougher to work with because there are jobs there to protect the lender's best interest, that we wanted to talk about some of these key things that have to be hopefully addressed in your offer early days versus not having them addressed. And then come closing time, there's a couple of things that are coming up. And then now everyone's scrambling to try to get it going. And you may or may not have a willing vendor to extend. You may have tenants that are in Ontario or down south from a national or international type standpoint that doesn't have like an estoppel department just waiting for your estoppels. So we bring Scott on today. We dive into some of these situations just to make sure everyone's fully aware. And to also, when you are buying and selling commercial real estate, to make sure the stuff that you do incorporate into those contracts.
That's right. It really emphasizes the importance of dealing with someone who knows what they're doing.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. So we have Scott on the program today. It's great. But big announcement this week came out from the BOC there.
I didn't hear.
You didn't hear? They dropped the policy rate by 6%.
I'm kidding. It's the only thing I've heard.
It's the only thing. They dropped it by 6%. Right now, it's negative 0.25. The BOC is giving away free money.
Free money.
Free money.
Back to 2021.
Back to 2021. No, the Bank of Canada rolled back the policy rate from 5 to 4.75. So they dropped it by 25 basis points.
Yep.
You know, that's great news. Great
Absolutely.
News. I don't really know, honestly, how much impact it's going to have in the short term. I think the residential side will see it more so than the commercial side.
Mm-hmm.
You get some people that get off the couch now. Maybe they're back out there looking. People may or may not realize how much of an impact it does make. You know, it may, depending on how much your mortgage amount is, it may only be a couple, you know, $60 a month for all we know.
Well, I think it's a signal for a path ahead.
Well, that's the biggest thing. That's the biggest message. The tightening measures hopefully are coming off.
Mm-hmm.
We're moving forward. We're on to the next. We're getting past this point.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, is the biggest message that comes out of this.
That's right.
That they didn't hold rates. We're moving on to that next phase.
It feels like the sun is out, you know?
Exactly. And literally it is today.
Bank
it's like
Canada
23 or 24 degrees today.
Brought the sun out.
Yeah. So now active. Now, my question for you, because like I said, I think you will see it before we'll see it on the commercial side. The announcement happened June 5th.
Yep.
Just a day and stamp this. We're recording this June 7th, 48 hours later.
Mm-hmm.
Have you gotten more phone calls from people that maybe weren't calling 2 days ago?
I've gotten a couple.
Yeah.
I've definitely gotten a couple. The funny thing is I was actually quite busy before that too.
But again, you're a rock star at what you do. You're always busy.
But I felt busier than I had been for a little while.
Okay. That's a good sign.
And, you know, people are all, inventory's up. I work with primarily buyers and I was very busy. And so all I could think is if these interest rates come down, it's
look out.
Yeah.
Cascade effect.
Yeah. But we'll see, who knows? But I think we're gonna maybe have a busy summer even.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
That'd be great. All right. Without further ado, let's get to our interview today with Scott McInnes, partner and lawyer at Red Point Law, talking about some of the key points of commercial real estate contracts.
All right, let's go.
Enjoy, guys. This podcast is presented by Impact Commercial.
Impact Commercial, John, Alan, the team over there are fantastic. They've all been on the show.
They have, yeah.
Friends of the show.
Great guys.
Wealth of experience. They can help with all your commercial financing needs.
Whether it's owner-occupiers, land development funds, commercial investments, or multifamily, these guys got you covered.
And they recently obtained their CMHC correspondent lender status.
So for all your commercial lending needs, visit them at impactcommercial.com. impactcommercial.ca.
That's impactcommercial.ca.
Attention realtors, homebuyers, and investors. If you missed out on Atlin at Clayton Crest by Zentera Developments, here's your second chance.
Atlin sold 80% in just 3 months, Adam. And because of that success, Zentera is launching Building 2, Butte.
Located in West Clayton and walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, prices are still low for now, but not for long.
Homeowners across the Lower Mainland are using equity from their current homes to invest in West Clayton, ahead of the SkyTrain and the next market upswing, because when that SkyTrain is complete and the market rebounds, it'll be too late.
This, Matt, is how wealth is built. Find out why Atlin sold so fast and register now at buttecondos.ca. That's B-U-T-E condos.ca.
Today we're here with Scott McInnes, lawyer and partner at Redpoint Law. Scott, how are you doing?
Hey, how are you two?
Good, thanks. Hey. Thanks so much for taking the time. We know you're super busy. We wanted to bring you back on to kind of talk about contracts and just how important they are and some language in those, because we feel like over the past few months, there's been a whole bunch of issues, a lot of it probably stemming from the tightening of the financial side of things. But we wanted to kind of review and update kind of just how important that stuff is. But before we get to that, can you maybe tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself and Redpoint Law?
Sure, yeah. Redpoint Law is a real estate and business firm. We came together in September of 2021. Me, Tim, and Falco are the partners. We have, I think our latest tally was there's about 20 of us all together, including staff and lawyers. So
wow.
Us three partners, we got three other lawyers that work there. And we just recently, as many people are aware, we expanded to Kelowna about a year ago, and it's been going great. I'm the sole partner on the ground up here.
Kelowna's a busy market. When are you guys opening in Victoria is the question.
We'd have to find somebody that wants to move there first.
Yeah. All right. Well, Scott, we're going to dive into this. You know, me and you talk all the time, and obviously for our podcast listeners, I'll recognize Redpoint Law as one of our sponsors here for the Six Pack, and we appreciate that. But me and you talk all the time. From the brokerage side of the business, it feels like over the past 3 or 4 months especially, that there's been a lot of challenges kind of getting close to the finish line of an actual transaction closing, whether it's getting delayed for some reason. Maybe there's some contract things that are kind of popping up from here and there. Estoppels aren't getting signed on time. So me and you were dealing with a couple of situations just from a William Wright standpoint to get some deals closed for some clients and some brokers. So we wanted to kind of dive in and refresh everything. I thought a lot of people may not put as much emphasis on how important the contract is and importance on the language in the contracts. And one of the things there that maybe we'll start with, estoppels and estoppel certificates. Now, a lot of people who don't know what an estoppel is typically provided by the purchaser or usually the purchaser's lawyer, one of the two. It's given to the landlord or to the agents involved to have both the landlord sign in some cases, but more importantly, the tenant sign to confirm they're in good standing, confirm the terms of their lease, just kind of a third party versus maybe never want to assume this, but maybe the landlord has provided a lease that may not be true. This estoppel kind of references that relationship and kind of proves the lease to be true in that circumstance. Am I correct with that saying there, Scott?
Yeah, that's a good summary.
And one thing we're having here is a lot of lenders want to get estoppels signed, maybe not all the tenants, but usually the anchors or sometimes in some cases all, usually, you know, close to closing, or sometimes it's a post-closing requirement where you have to get them turned in within so many days after closing. But it feels like a lot of them are becoming like a pre-funding requirement now prior to closing. And there's a lot of scrambling going on. So can maybe you maybe elaborate a little bit maybe on what an estoppel is and just the importance of the estoppels, because that's one thing that we're seeing challenging across the board right now.
You hit the nail on the head. The estoppel certificates are kind of statements by landlord and more importantly, the tenant, as you noted, where they are going to make representations to whoever wants that document. And, you know, in most cases, it's lenders, but they're going to, you know, certify that the lease, you know, commenced in such and such day, the monthly payment of rent is this amount, the square footage is this amount, they're not in default. And those are important calculations for the lender. And, you know, I'm not a mortgage broker, but, you know, it all gets thrown into their evaluation of the property and the loan, right? If they're going to loan, you know, over a 20 tenant property, they're going to want to know what the income is coming in from to the owner and what the expenses are. So to the extent that they're, you know, on the margins of what their loan to value is, like, they need that information locked up so that they can make a proper assessment of what the risk is that they're agreeing to loan on. And many times in the contract, as a kind of a general statement, most often the contracts come to us lawyers before we've had any input. And most of the time, like, I've dealt with a lot of your brokers, everyone's done a great job and there's no hiccups and we don't have to think about, you know, the meaning of a certain phrase. But every once in a while, something will crop up where, had we been involved at the outset, we maybe would have done it a bit a different way or used some different words. And then we're kind of boxed in. So the issue of estoppels, like, most purchase contracts will have a subject to financing. And part of the discussion with the buyer and their lender or mortgage broker is, you know, what is the lender going to require? And if they get a green light to go ahead, and then at a later day, they get told that the estoppels are required in order to fund, there's going to, and there's no requirement for the vendor to give estoppels or even ask for them, there's going to be a big problem. Like, I think, you know, 90% of the time, everybody wants to get a deal done. And, you know, the vendor may go and ask for estoppels, even if they have no contractual requirement to. However, you know, you could run into the situation where the vendor goes, you know what, I don't want to ask for that. You haven't given me a clear covenant in the contract that requires me to ask for that. So I'm not going to ask for that. And then it becomes a big issue. So, you know, and then you could be in a position where you can't close because you don't have the right to those estoppels and they're not even going to ask for them.
And maybe we go one step even back, that if you're a landlord and you have your standard form lease for a building, you should make sure in your lease that when your tenants enter into those leases with you, that you have something in there that would, force, but the tenant would have to review and sign that estoppel within a certain period of time and deliver it back to the landlord upon request. That way, you don't run into this problem, because you can sometimes, you know, you might find a willing vendor that wants to close, but sometimes you get a very unwilling tenant. And I remember one situation that we had to deal with for a client where it didn't require the tenant to provide estoppels in the leases of the building. And that landlord, to get that sale over the line, had to give that tenant 2 months free rent and 2 assigned parking stalls for the balance of their lease in order for them to sign the estoppel.
Yikes. Yeah. That's a secondary question. Even if the vendor is going to play ball, you know, do they have a right to ask for these estoppels? Because in the absence of that right in the lease, then there is no common law requirement for the tenant to pony up an estoppel. So in our standard form leases, we put in that, you know, tenant will execute on 10 days notice any kind of estoppel in the landlord's standard form acting reasonably. And then that gives the landlord the right to request them. Doesn't necessarily mean that they have to under a contract to purchase and sale, but like I say, most people want to play ball and get a deal done.
Yeah, and I think right now too, with the lending world the way it currently is, and we're coming off of this recent announcement by Tim Macklin's group there at the BOC that the policy rates come off 25 basis points to 4.75, which is a great sign. I think, you know, the tightening measures are coming off. But like I said, and the other thing you got to be careful of with these estoppels is, if you have a franchise tenant or you have a corporate covenant on the lease that requires them to sign the estoppel, you can't be delivering the estoppel 2 days prior to closing to Life Labs and think that someone in the Life Labs department in Ontario is sitting there just waiting for it, or a Subway or a 7-Eleven. Sometimes these big corporate tenants or franchise tenants need a lot of time to deal with this. So the estoppel is one thing too. I know internally in our company, we're talking about it lots right now, but making sure that we have proper language in those offers now that would allow for the closing to get pushed if it was out of the purchaser's hands getting those estoppels and they were required, but also the importance of who these tenants are and getting the estoppels on time.
Yeah, for sure. That's another, you know, common wrinkle where the tenant is such a, you know, large organization that nobody wants to put their mark on the estoppel and you know, have it come back and bite them. It's kind of like a diffusion of responsibility where everybody's just waiting until it gets to the right person that feels comfortable enough to make that representation. It's just another line of red tape. And yeah, if you give Subway an estoppel 2 days before closing, good luck.
Yeah. And one thing we've seen some lenders do is instead of making them post-closing requirements, this is a lender by lender or deal by deal situation, but actually withhold part of the advance until that estoppel comes in. So for how that works, if you're a buyer and I have to put down $1 million plus my closing cost to close the property, and I have a lender, CIBC, might say to me, hey, Corey, you couldn't get the estoppel for Canadian Tire. We're going to withhold $100,000 from that advance. To me as the buyer, I now have to put an extra $100,000 in because the bank's going to lend me my initial amount based on my loan to value, less the $100,000 holdback. So I have to have that capital available to me to put into the lawyer's account to close the property, chase Canadian Tire after, get my estoppel, deliver it to the lender in order to get that money back. And there might be a time restraint on it. So the importance of estoppels right now, it feels like in the lending environment, is so important that I think they're not just kind of an afterthought, which they probably felt like years ago, that this is something that a lot of people, when you're buying or selling properties, you want to make sure these estoppel things are addressed hopefully very early on in that process and not left to the last minute in case the lender comes back and puts a big onus on it and doesn't give the full advance or may not want to close depending on how many estoppels you're missing.
Yeah, exactly. Because if they can't get that estoppel, now their calculation of their own risk and exposure and what the potential market value of the property is now shifted.
Yeah.
So, you know, they may say, you know what, we can't rely on the fact that you have an anchor tenant that's paying you such and such, right? Our risk, you know, risk to reward ratio now on this loan is adjusted such that we're only going to advance to you, you know, $100K less or something like that.
Yeah.
And yeah, you would have a post-closing covenant of, you know, 30, 60, 90 days to get that to them in order to release the balance. And if you can't, like, you know, you might be hooped and you might be out of those funds.
Yeah, no, it's super important. And I know, you know, if you don't have that money, extra money set aside, it can be a mad scramble where you're calling the BOC to try, or sorry, the BOC, the Bank of Mom and Dad, to try to get, the BOC ain't going to give you any money. You're calling the bank of mom and dad maybe to try to get that extra money last minute in order to close the property. Another issue that we feel like we've dealt with more and more, and again, this is so important to address when you're putting these offers, is a lot of vendor or a lot of people may not be aware. When you buy new construction or a resale of any commercial property, you've got to pay GST. And if you get a first-time commercial buyer that maybe has bought and sold a house before, or they bought a pre-sale condo from Melissa, and Melissa says, hey, you're buying the condo for $1 million, but you have to pay GST to the developer on the new sale, but you don't have to pay it on the resale. In commercial, you have to pay GST every time. There's obviously some exemptions to that. But one thing I want to kind of bring up, and maybe I'll let you talk about the exemption part from the legal standpoint, but also what's really important is in order to exempt the GST, you have to have GST numbers both on the buy and sell side, if I'm correct. But you have to have active GST numbers. And a lot of times what happens is Melissa's going to go buy a property with some of her friends. They go incorporate a brand new company over at Red Point Law. And in order to get the GST exemption at closing, they've got to go register that new company for a GST number and make it active on or before the day of closing in order to exempt the GST. So when people have these new companies, they need GST numbers in order to activate them. And we've seen time and time again where buyers are maybe heading into the closing and they either A, haven't got their GST number yet, or B, they got their GST number, but they made it active like the day after closing. And that can create a mad problem when it comes time if you have to pay 5% GST. So can you maybe talk a little bit about from the legal perspective, how that exemption process works and what would happen if Melissa's buying a property and she has to close today and she doesn't have her GST number?
You're right. GST on commercial property is virtually always payable. The way that it's most often done is that buyer and seller are both registered for GST, and both sides of this transaction will be searching GST numbers, and the vendor will expect on closing one of two things. Either the purchaser is going to pony up 5% of the purchase price, which is the GST, and pay it to the vendor, and then the vendor will remit it. Or if both parties are registered, they're going to expect a proof of registered status to be provided by the buyer, as well as a GST certificate. I believe it's form 221/B or C, something like that, that basically is a certification that says, hey, I'm registered for GST and I will go account for all the GST applicable. And it's not quite an exemption. It's more of an ability for a buyer to go and reconcile their own GST obligations with CRA on their next filing. And how that is exactly done is done by accountants. So I don't want to go too far into their lane, but that's how we paper the transaction. Either the buyer and seller are both companies registered for GST, or the buyer is going to pay the 5% GST. And the second part of your question, what happens if the buyer is not registered? Then the vendor will insist on them coming up with the 5% GST, and it will be basically a default of contract if the buyer is not able to do that.
So let me get this straight here. I'm just going to pull my calculator out here for a second here. So I'm buying a property, Melissa is buying a property for $10 million. Okay. She's done really well. She's got this great investment group. They're buying a property for $10 million. Whoops. She forgot to register a GST. It's 3 p.m. on the day of closing. She's just realized that the lawyers have pulled the certs. It's not registered. You're telling me Melissa now has to go get $500,000 to put down as GST, 5% on the $10 million purchase.
Yeah, exactly. And it can be a big shock, right?
Wow.
I think probably most lawyers who practice, you know, real estate and commercial real estate have at one time or another had a file where they go, oh crap, the buyer, whether it's their client or the other side, isn't registered for GST. And it is a mad scramble to get an account. Like you and I have had at least five files, where we needed somebody to register them for GST, like immediately.
Yeah. And just for the record, those aren't like our purchases, because we register early for GST. These are other people we're helping.
Well, yeah, just files that are on our lap.
Yeah.
As soon as an LP's got done up, we got the accountant the information, you know, he needs to register for GST. But, you know, even as a young lawyer, I had files where, you know, it's a couple of days out, then we go, oh man, we got to register for GST. You better find an accountant.
And you know how easy it is when you call the CRA, they answer right away, first ring, right? So there's no wait time needed when you call the CRA, right? Like you call them on Tuesday, you'll get through like four Wednesdays later. Like it's just, you got to get this done early is what we're trying to stress here. So now in that circumstance, Melissa's buying the building. She maybe doesn't have the $500,000 just lying around in her account. Can she still close that deal that day and deal with the GST after the fact? Or can that sale like not close from a government standpoint, because someone's got to pay this GST. Can that deal not close? That deal, like Melissa's in default, the seller can't close even if they want to because the GST number is not active. Is that how serious this is?
Well, yeah, but now I got to be a little careful. So I am aware that the CRA can, in theory, backdate a GST registration, and I believe it's for up to 30 days. Okay. However, most contracts of purchase and sale, including the Real Estate Council one and most of the ones that you're using, have covenants in there that kind of overwrite that and say, buyer will be registered on GST or will pay the GST. So, you know, if that situation comes up and buyer's not registered, vendor is just going to say, look, pay me the GST or you're in breach of contract, because they're not going to accept sale proceeds without the buyer being registered, or, you know, they would just have an addendum extending it.
Gotcha. So realistically, it's not going to close over this GST. We need to deal with it. And hopefully you have a willing vendor that's going to give you the 1 day extension. The one thing too, that if this does happen, is a lot of times vendors have carrying costs. If you want them to carry the property for another day or 2 days, they might have interest. They have to pay, they're paying their mortgage. There might be a whole bunch of costs that maybe that vendor is going to ask you for $3,500 or $5,000 or $10,000 to extend, because now he's going to incur all these other costs and he might have to have his lawyer redo some paperwork, that you're kind of putting that vendor in kind of a little bit of an awkward situation. To go one step further, maybe that vendor's insurance is up and that might be a whole issue all upon itself. They now be scrambling to try to get their insurance extended for a day because, I mean, they're supposed to be closing.
Yeah, exactly. So there are a whole host of complications that come into it when a vendor, you know, wants, whether a vendor agrees to extend pursuant to a buyer's request, whether it's for GST or not. But, you know, because what the vendor is going to think about is, okay, what are all the ways that I am financially impacted, and maybe it's their time that's impacted too. Maybe they're out of country and now they got to go, you know, figure something out on the fly, and they're kind of annoyed. Because, you know, to be quite honest, the vendor has the buyer between a rock and a hard place. Like, the buyer is basically asking for kind of empathy and saying, hey, listen, what's your cost? Please agree to an addendum, you know, and it's up to the vendor on how ridiculous they want to be. Because, you know, depending on the purchase price, the deposit could be at risk if they can't complete.
So literally, this could be like $1 million mistake here. If someone doesn't close and then the vendor's not willing to extend and now they want to go after deposit, or maybe the contract says if you don't close, that deposit is paid immediately as liquidated damages, it's forfeited. It could be a whole bunch of things here. So this is a huge, huge issue you got to make sure you get right. So Scott, one other thing too, we have, I mean, obviously we've talked on this program a lot about, and if people are buying and selling commercial real estate, a lot of times you can buy the shares of the holding company or Bear Trust Company, I guess even OpCo, if they own the land. If someone's going to buy a share purchase or buy the shares versus buying the asset from them, what is the difference, or should, at what point should we be addressing the share purchase agreement? And maybe that could be, maybe that's dictated based on how it's held, Bear Trust versus HoldCo or OpCo. At what point should that be addressed in the offer process? Should that be a condition of the deal to review and negotiate during conditions? Or is it something that can be dealt with like at a later point?
Yeah, it should absolutely be done before removing conditions, because, you know, share purchases are very complex documents that have a lot of interlinkages, you know, between commercial leases, share purchase agreements, and shareholders agreements. Those are kind of the three of the most complex documents, certainly that I practice. And, you know, narrowing the scope down of a share purchase about how, you know, what are the reps that the vendors are going to make? How are the tax returns going to be, you know, discussed between both parties on the change of control? What are the indemnity provisions? How long are the indemnity provisions going to last? Like, you know, a share purchase can be, you know, 60 to 100 pages, depending on the complexity. It can be shorter, but to your first comment, one of the first questions you're going to ask is, are these shares, is it basically the purchase of a trust insofar as, are these shares of the company, is the company holding the property in trust for a beneficial owner? Because if that's the case, then technically the company should have mostly nil activity that you don't really need to get too far into. Now, if the company is an actual operating entity and is running everything through, you know, claiming all the revenue, claiming all the tax, then yeah, it's quite a lot more work that goes into the share purchase versus if it's just a purchase of a trust.
So this is something that if, let's say, for example, if it's held in a trust, it's a simpler share purchase agreement because of the nil reports and the liability issues, versus if it's just a pure holding co that's not a Bear Trust, that is something that potentially there should be either have a condition in the deal subject to negotiating a share purchase agreement, just to make sure there's not additional covenants or reps and warrants to get thrown in last minute. Is that kind of the basis why we should deal with that during our due diligence period?
Yeah, exactly. Because if you have a contract to purchase and sale for real estate, and, you know, there's a clause in there that says, you know, this contract, the closing shall be done by way of share purchase, like to be agreed to later. Yeah. I think there's a good argument that the contract may not be binding and that it's deficient in a lot of the main business points that are going to come up in, you know, between buyer and seller in negotiating the terms of the share purchase.
So one thing there, we talked just very briefly on it. So we've covered, you know, share purchase agreements are becoming a big part of our transaction process. That's something that we have to deal with maybe during our due diligence period, it sounds like, or put more emphasis on it. I know some people shy away, but we can't do that. We talked there, I just brought up really, really briefly reps and warrants. And those are obviously some things that may come back to be a problem maybe at closing if it's not properly addressed in there. Like, I remember one transaction we had where the one side, I can't remember, I'm pretty sure it was the purchase side, wanted the reps and warrants to kind of run into perpetuity versus the vendor was kind of like, hey, we're going to give you like a 12-month survival after closing. Can you talk a little bit around just general talk of what reps and warrants are, and just maybe the importance of some of those reps and warrants if you're a buyer or a seller?
Sure, yeah. Reps and warranties are essentially statements of fact that a vendor is going to make about the property. Whether it's shares, even it also relates to just the commercial real estate itself. But there are statements of fact that the vendor is making that the purchaser is relying on. So, for example, in a share purchase, the company has no employees and has not had any employees for the past 10 years. That's important to a buyer because they want to know, you know, were there any employees of the company? Were any possibly, you know, improperly terminated? Because as opposed to a purchase of real estate, the buyer is going to inherit all of the liabilities that the company could have pre-closing. Now, there are ways to get around that with indemnities where, you know, vendor agrees to indemnify the purchaser for any and all liabilities of the company, you know, prior to the completion date. But you don't want to be chasing a vendor that may or may not be around, you know, to collect on an indemnity where, you know, you could have had some more clarity on this particular point. And the bulk of a share purchase agreement will be reps and warranties. Like, it's often half of the document is statements of fact that the vendor's making. Because if any of those warranties turn out to be untrue, then the purchaser has certain remedies depending on, you know, how they're untrue, if they're made innocently or whether they're made fraudulently or negligently. And that's kind of what the buyer's getting is, the buyer's getting a piece of property, right? There could be all kinds of things wrong with this property, as opposed to the vendor who just wants money. It's very difficult to have an issue with money as long as it, you know, matches up to the dollar figure that it's on the contract.
That makes a lot of sense. So reps and warrants. And then obviously from the survival standpoint, I know we've typically, I don't say typically, but maybe it's like 12, 18 or 24 months, some of these reps and warrants survive. Is there anything there if I'm on a sell side of things that's a rep or warrant that I don't want to have run into perpetuity or I want to limit?
You kind of want to limit all of them. Certainly some are going to be more important than others, but it's going to be kind of a balancing act of power between the parties, right? The vendor ideally wants to make these reps, walk away, clean their hands, never think about this property again. So in an ideal world, those reps are going to survive as little as possible. Now on the buyer's side, if they find out something in year two and it's contrary to what they thought they were buying, but the reps have expired, you know, they're going to be kind of out of luck.
Yeah, so
some of the
sense.
Most important reps and warranties for the purchaser would be tax representations, you know, environmental representations about the financial statements. You're going to want those to survive longer than, you know, the vendor is, you know, a duly constituted company incorporated. You know, that may not, you might be able to check that yourself by searching online. But
yeah. I guess one other thing that I think we should maybe bring up here that I always try to stress, I know in our company that's so important is, you know, dates in a contract. You know, I mean, those dates circle around maybe deposits or something happening by a certain date. If I buy a property and I get my deposit in one day late, but I don't do an addendum to the contract to acknowledge that, how would that potentially come back to haunt me in the event this contract wants to try to get unwound at some point because one side wants out of it? If a deposit shows up at 24 hours outside of the date in which it's due, how important is that in that contract?
I mean, it's only important insofar as everyone is not getting along anymore. So, now 99% of contracts will have what looks like boilerplate to most people, but it's actually a very important clause, and it's called time is of the essence. And what time is of the essence means is if you are one nanosecond past, you know, the time at which something is supposed to occur, doesn't matter. Whatever occurs based on that late nanosecond is going to occur. So for example, if the contract calls for subjects to be removed, you know, on or before June 11th at 5 p.m., if June 11th at 5:01 happens and subjects aren't removed in writing, the contract is technically dead. And many, many realtors will simply, by way of addendum, you know, backdate the subject removal so to make it fall within that time frame. But if everyone's, you know, proceeding along wanting to get the transaction done, there's no issue. But if something goes funny and say the buyer realizes, you know what, I've made a mistake and I kind of want to back out, there's an argument that they could make, provided that they were, you know, making reasonable efforts to remove those subjects. But there's an argument that they could say at a later day, you know what, subjects weren't removed properly and were terminating the contract. And whether or not that survived the court looking at it, certainly going to tie the property up while everybody litigates it.
Yeah, that's super. Yeah, no, it makes, I don't think people realize how important some of these dates can be until a problem arises and someone wants to get out. And then they start going back and they're looking at, I mean, the chronicle timeline of events that happened or didn't happen, and then trying to obviously point towards those events that didn't happen or didn't take place in time to try to unwind this contract.
Yeah, and the proper way to do it is to prepare what's called a revival and reinstatement agreement. And basically what that says is, hey, we were parties under this contract. It died because of ABC. You know, we are now reinstating it on, you know, the same terms and conditions except as follows. And then most often what follows is just an amendment to the date, the completion, potentially the subject removal. Everybody signs it and now the contract's back in play. But yeah, without that document, technically, you know, if push comes to shove, you know, it's dead.
Well, Scott, I appreciate you taking the time to come chat with us. I know you're busy, and I appreciate kind of talking to some of these points here that feel like they've kind of become more common, unfortunately, in some transactions. Like, stop holds are playing more of an importance thing right now here. But Scott, before we let you go, we got a 6-pack of lighthearted questions. You know how it works. Can you hang out for just a few more minutes?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. We'll see if these are different than the last time I answered them.
Well, we've tried to make them different, but the problem is some of them are just so damn good that we just got to keep getting them. I know there's one there that we're going to be asking you that I know the previous answer, we're looking for something different. So I'm going to kick this off here. A book recommendation for our listeners.
Oh, book recommendation. All right, I'll throw a curveball.
Okay.
Alas, Babylon by Pat Frank.
Mm. Oh, it's like a screwball there. Elaborate more on that one.
It's a fiction book. It's a fiction book about nuclear war written in the 50s or 60s.
That's way over my pay grade. That's way over my pay grade.
All right. Next question.
You're a far smarter man than I'll ever be, Scott.
Yeah. Next question. You found yourself on death row. What's your last meal?
Ooh. I'm going to go with some authentic, like, Mexican street tacos.
Ooh, street meat.
Anywhere in particular you're getting the tacos?
The street, obviously.
Well, there's a restaurant down in Playa del Carmen I've been to a bunch, but, you know, as long as they're authentic, I'll take them.
Have you ever been in Mexico and then, you know, 2 a.m. you're getting out of a bar or something and there's just like an old abuela selling tacos? That's the best. That is the best. You're not going to get any better.
Yeah, some of those. I'll take those.
Between the book and the food, this is way over my head here. All right, Scott, this is the one I remember how you answered this last time. I think you kind of kicked off a trend, if I remember correctly here. But
oh no,
favorite band or musician?
Yeah, I know. I went with Mob Deep.
Yeah, yeah. So when I say you kicked off a trend, you joined us very early days when we launched this podcast, and I remember you picked Mob Deep, like rap days from high school, and it was kind of like, I thought I knew Scott. And then as the longer the podcast went on, the more and more the common thread of people in commercial real estate is everybody likes 90s rap. So you started a trend there that a lot of guests followed there. So favorite band or musician? We know what it was previously, but you got to have another favorite band there than Mobb Deep, I would think.
Okay, I'm going to keep the trend going. And I'm going to pick Big L.
Big L.
Big L. I don't think I've heard of Big L. Can you maybe let us know about Big L?
So he was a rapper in the 90s. He had a pretty short career. He was actually shot and killed, but he still got a bit of a cult following.
Oh.
Little L.
Big L.
Big L. Not little L. Big L. Capital.
Just rolled over in his grave, you call him
Big L. Oh, jeez. This 6-pack ain't going very well here.
Oh, no.
All right. What's the next question?
All right. Next question. Favorite TV show?
Favorite TV show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, just recently I watched the Fallout series on Amazon. I really liked that one.
The Fallout series? Which one was that? I don't think I've watched that one yet. What's that one about?
Kind of post-apocalypse. It's actually based on a video game. They dumped a lot of money into it. I think they got season 2 now.
Oh, wow. Wow. Okay. I'll have to put that on the list. When you find the time, I know you are busy. Favorite vacation spot? I know you live in Kelowna, so you might just want to say where you live, but favorite vacation spot?
Mexico.
The street meet.
Street meet
in Mexico. Exactly. All right, Scott, last question up here.
Who's going to win the Stanley Cup?
Is Edmonton bringing it home for Canada?
Oh, yeah, I'm going to go with Edmonton.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you got a 50% chance, so that's pretty good. Win. I think I'm going to follow Scott's lead and think Edmonton's going to bring it home.
All right.
Edmonton's going to beat the Panthers. In 6 games. I'm going to say 6 games. Yeah, 6 games. And the Panthers are going to have a major injury, unfortunately, that's going to take them out of the series. That's my prediction.
Okay.
There you go.
Let's see.
Scott, for all those people who want to find out more about all the amazing work you guys are doing at Redpoint Law, or they have any commercial legal work they need done, how can they find out more about you?
Well, they can go on our website. All our emails are there and my direct number is there. So happy to chat with anyone. They can give me a ring.
Excellent. Well, Scott, thank you so much once again for taking the time to join us. We appreciate kind of recapping some of the key points there, those contracts to try to avoid these multi-million dollar mistakes in real estate.
Thanks, Scott.
Yep, sounds good.
Thanks, Scott. Take care. Bye-bye. And there you have it, folks. Our interview with Scott McInnes, partner at Redpoint Law, talking about GST, talking about estoppels, share purchase agreements, talking about reps and warrants, all these things that a lot of times, and let's just call a spade a spade. If we surveyed 100 buyers, whether they're commercial or residential, mm-hmm. how many of them probably read the whole contract front to back? Probably very, very little.
Absolutely.
Right? Very, very little. And to Scott's point, contracts are never problems if everyone's willing to kind of do the deal. Mm-hmm. They become a problem when something comes up that maybe one side wants to get out of the contract. One side, we maybe didn't fulfill the other side of it. And fingers are pointing. Then we go back to the print.
Yeah.
Right. So we talked about, Scott made some really good points there. I know estoppels are one thing that seemed like they've become much more important in our side of the business. They've always been important, but they seem like they're becoming really important now with lenders, where maybe before they could be kind of like post-closing requirements, where now it feels like a lot of lenders are making them kind of pre-funding requirements heading into it. And we kind of addressed that there with Scott, making sure you've got the right language in your offers to get these estoppels. But also if you're a landlord, you want to make sure you have the right language in your leases for your tenants that when you provide them, they will sign them and deliver them to you.
The more you know.
The more you know. All right. And Melissa, we discussed before, we're on a tight timeline here because after this, I'm heading up to our annual William Wright Whistler retreat.
Now that sounds like a good time.
It's a great time. We invite all 7 offices and all of our admin staff and some of our key partners that we work with throughout the year all to come up there. And we have a big dinner tonight, a big welcome dinner tonight. Then everyone's kind of out and about in the village. Tomorrow, wow. There's a whole bunch of us golfing. Some people are going to the spa. For those who don't want to do one of those things, we give them gift cards to go shopping in the village. Yeah, 100% you can come. You're part of the team.
The listeners want to come too.
The listeners want to come. I remember one year.
I think you got to raffle that off. Why? You raffled off the Nickelback tickets and...
No. We changed somebody's life with Nickelback tickets.
They want an experience like this.
They want the Will.
They want to come to the William Wright
party. Whistler retreat.
Absolutely.
Experience. Well, I remember we brought Matt up from the podcast. Yeah. I think it was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And he looked lost. Yeah, he was lost. I'm just kidding. He had a great time.
In a good way.
He had so much fun up there. It was awesome. I know we tried to get Adam to come up. You got to come up 1 year.
I will.
You got to come up there. We have like Al from Impact, and we had Ben on from Brass Financial recently, who does a lot of accounting work for us throughout the year. So he comes up. So it's a great time to thank everyone for all their hard work throughout the year.
Amazing.
There's a lot of good, and it's great to get everyone in the province together at one time.
Well, it's a great weekend for it.
It's great. So I have to eventually, unfortunately, take off early today
to get there.
Before we do that, if people do want to buy and sell commercial real estate, they can reach out to us anytime at our Vancouver office, 604-428-5255. Let us know what you're looking for and we'll put you in touch with the best broker throughout the province for that. You can send me an email anytime, corey@williamwright.ca. Always happy to talk about the podcast or anything else real estate related. Or you can go to our website, williamwright.ca, and sign up for the latest and greatest news. And for Melissa, for those who want to take advantage of the 25 basis point drop here by the BOC, which will be reflective more in your 1 and 2 year fix versus your 5.
Yep.
How can people get a hold of you?
Do it as soon as possible because interest rates are probably coming down even more. But if you're buying, let's go.
Yeah.
There you go.
But how can they get a hold of you?
778-869-4477 or email me, melissa@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
Thanks for joining us, guys. And we'll be back next week with another great episode.
All right.
Take care.
Subscribe today.